Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Finance on Instagram. What's not to like? The Instagram generation might be criticised for loving consumption-fuelled images of designer clothes, expensive brunches, and exotic holidays, but the platform is increasingly providing the inspo for those looking to save money, learn to budget, and even start a retirement fund or get out of debt. For the younger generation, is getting financial advice via social media a good idea? Well, today I'm thrashing this out on the podcast with Catherine Gemmell, a 24-year-old reporter for FT Money, and Jason Butler, the FT columnist who is, dare I say, more than twice Catherine's age. But he has spent 30 years working in financial services and has lots to tell us about it. So welcome to a special multi-generational edition of the FT Money Show, the FT's weekly podcast about personal finance and investing. I am Claire Barrett, FT Money editor, presiding over this week's bun fight. So amid the deluge of selfies, content creators around the world are bringing financial education into the social media mainstream by talking about their money on Instagram. Now, Catherine, you've come to FT Money on an internship through PA News.
Yep.
You are somebody who does Instagram.
Yep.
I am somebody who's trying to learn as a 43-year-old, lamely trying to be hip. But for the benefit of the people in the audience who are not Insta stars, how does Instagram actually work?
So Instagram is a photo and video sharing app where you post visual content and keep up to date with your friends, families, favourite celebrities and influencers. It first came onto the scene in 2010, and since Facebook acquired the platform for $1 billion 8 years ago, it now boasts 1 billion active users.
Wow.
500 million of whom use the platform daily.
So taking a photograph of something, because you can't do a post without taking a photograph, it's not like Twitter or Facebook. If you're talking about money, which is what your article was revealing, I mean, other than taking pictures of notes and coins, it doesn't strike me as the most illustrative subject. And I say that as somebody who spent much of the last 4 years trying to find innovative ways of illustrating articles in the FT Money section of the weekend newspaper. So what on earth are people posting pictures of?
So Instagram's all about pictures, so it's so much more engaging than other social networks. And this is where the real value of it lies in comparisons to the like of Facebook. So obviously money isn't certainly something that comes across as visual. However, these money Instagrammers are using visual tools to spark an emotional response to money. Mm. So they use the likes of colourful stationery, calligraphy to get their message across, or Inspogram, as some like to call it.
Inspogram. Well, I like that. And you identified various different kind of communities of people on Instagram who are united because they follow each other or they use hashtags to make sure that they're all talking about the same thing. Like the hashtag debt-free community is one that particularly interested me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so within the personal finance community on Instagram, you have what content marketers like to call tribes.
Tribes.
So these are sort of micro communities within the bigger Instagram community. You have your frugal types and your budgeters who show how to live a fulfilling life on a budget. Then you also have your parental bloggers who talk about the financial realities of parenthood. These provide support and inspiration. And then there's also, aside from these, you have your investment types and your FIRE crew, which is Financial Independence Retire Early.
Yes. Now, I've written before about financial independence, retire early. This is a US movement. I think we could say people who advocate saving large amounts of their disposable income as young people, like yourself, mm-hmm. so that they can stop work or achieve a greater work-life balance later on in life, largely through investing in low-cost tracker funds. So interesting that the kind of investment community is gaining traction. There's a lot of people who are doing FIRE have got quite a lot of money. They're not people who are young and potless.
This is true, yes. So it just shows the many shades of the Instagram personal finance community. You have your people who have a lot of money and are showing how to invest and use that money. But then you also have the other end of it, like the debt-free community, like you talked about, and people who are really struggling and using the app as a way to connect with other people and strive towards being debt-free.
Now, as somebody who's written a lot about debt in Britain, certainly the Financial Conduct Authority this week said that nearly 8 million Britons are in serious levels of problem debt, which is a worry for us all. I really like the fact that people are using the Instagram platform to be really up close and personal about how they're dealing with their debt problems, because it's such a taboo subject. I mean, it takes the average person in problem debt more than 2 years before they'll consider phoning up a debt helpline, which is something I learned last year, which is just a staggering statistic. And one of the people who you interviewed in your article, she had been so open about paying down her credit card debt, revealing how much she'd paid in different posts, how much was left, if she'd made a slip up. And she says that she's still being contacted, even now that she has paid off that debt, by so many people who are seeing those posts now for the first time and learning and in their own journey, as people like to say, towards becoming debt-free.
Yes, definitely. I think that that's one of the things that really became apparent when talking to these Instagrammers, was that the support that they got from the community when they just post a simple thing like saying, this is how much I've paid off, even if it was a really small amount or a big amount, it really helped them on this journey, as a lot of the people like to call it. And it let them keep going, and it gave them a little bit of a boost, because as we know, money and mental health are really interconnected, and sometimes when you're on your debt-free journey it can feel lonely, so Instagram makes it feel a little less so.
So clearly there are lots of things that are happening on Instagram that we can agree are good, but there are also things, unfortunately, that we can definitely agree are bad. Insta scams is mm-hmm. how it's been summed up.
Yes. So last year, the UK fraud authorities warned that hundreds of Instagram users had been suckered into a promise of high returns and losing nearly £9,000 on average. But Instagram has a help page that helps you to report these scams. So if anything doesn't seem right, if people are offering you large returns for small amounts, then you should probably go on that page and report it as suspicious.
Well, thanks for running us through your piece, Catherine. If anyone wants to read it, by the way, we have put it on Instagram and it is free to read on ft.com/money. Finance on Instagram, what's not to like, is the headline to look out for. But Jason Butler, I'm going to bring you in now. I mean, one of the things that you noticed about Instagram, as somebody who is you know, you're I think you're what young people would call a lurker. you've had a look at it, but you're not actively posting on Instagram yourself yet, although that may change. What struck you about the platform?
Well, it's like everything. Financial pornography, as I call it, is everywhere. So in other words, there's a lot of noise out there. And you think of Instagram, as I always say to people, you don't think about social media platforms. What you've got to think about is the message, the intention, the motivation, and ultimately how someone's going to react to a message or content. And all that Instagram is a means, it's a platform for which people can connect with, as Catherine was saying, tribes or micro-communities or certain groups of people. A bit like Channel 4 when it first opened in the 80s. You could. I remember a client of mine who was very high in advertising. He said, I can target a sort of gay guys in their 20s easier through that medium than any other at the time in the 80s in terms of advertising reach. And it's the same with Instagram. So you've got to sort of go beyond the noise. It is a platform. It's a very, very noisy platform, but it has limitations in terms of what it can actually get through. So the good thing is that I've seen is that there are innovative ways that you get people thinking and becoming self-aware and kind of, as you say, whether it's they're in difficulties with debt, owning up to that and taking some action and doing something about it, or the fire movement. So in my case, you know, I've got strong views about fire as a movement, but as a principle for becoming financially independent is a great thing, but don't feel so bad if you don't want to become part of a fire community and be financially independent at 35. You're not a bad person. So if it inspires people, I've seen some great inspiring, what I call hooks in there. But then when you dig through some of this, some of the people are charlatans, or they're even what I call unconsciously incompetent. They don't actually know what they're doing. They're content creators who have just happened to have come across for personal finance as a kind of as another hook. And some of them are well-intentioned. And as we found with scammers, some of them actually have ill intent.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that I was really struck by that you immediately noticed is the number of women on Instagram who have built up massive followings. I mean, many of them are Americans. The budget mom we talked about in the piece, we really like her. But also young people and women in general are exactly the kind of people that the mainstream financial services industry is not really talking to at the moment. So should we really be surprised that Instagram is becoming a forum they can express themselves in?
Yes, they've been disenfranchised groups, definitely young people and female, and to a lesser extent, some racial groups, as you'll see in different countries. But I think I think what you're actually seeing is that money really is an emotional construct. It's an abstract thing, and it is actually more about emotion, about the stories you tell yourself, about the excuses you give yourself, about the impulses you have, about the voids that you need to fill, about the addictions you've got to feel, whatever it is, or even that you want to brag to the world to make yourself feel better that aren't you great. Whatever it is, it's an emotional thing, and money's just one of those excuses to connect with people emotionally. And when you realise that money is an emotional thing, it's not about a maths test. I mean, there are aspects of it that you need to know functionally, but mostly money is an emotional and behavioural issue. And therefore, if people can connect with you, as Catherine was saying earlier, emotionally, then you've got attention, and attention is the big problem. So yeah, I think that's a reason why some of these micro groups, but particularly females and young people, are connecting, because we're much more open now about our feelings, our mental health, and money and mental health is up there with, you know, breathing and eating.
Absolutely. Interesting that you use the word telling ourselves stories about money, Jason, because one of the things that Catherine has explained to me over the last few weeks is how to do a story on Instagram. Do you want to enlighten any other similarly middle-aged people who are listening?
Yeah, so on Instagram, as a lot of people know, you can post your standard grid post, which is basically the picture that comes up under your account. But aside from this, you can also use the story function, which basically means that you can put up a picture or a video and it lasts for 24 hours and it's associated with your account for only that long. So you can put up, maybe if you're out at an event or if you're cooking something nice to dinner, and it'll be there for 24 hours and it'll disappear. But if you don't want it to disappear after 24 hours, you can make it a highlight function with on your page. So, for instance, when Claire last week asked me, how do I pin this to my profile? That she made a lovely little collection about
your article, about my article, about where to get the best overdraft.
Yeah. So it's a great function to be able to tell stories. And I think that's what a lot of these Instagrammers, from personal finance Instagrammers, are doing, is using it as a way to tell stories, to share information with people, and to educate.
Well, certainly, if you want to follow the FT on Instagram at Financial Times, I think it's nearly 2 million people who are doing that. Sadly, there's only about 400 people who follow me. I'm at Claire B, but as Jason said, you know, our obsessions come out on social media, and mine is mostly to do with saving money, cooking thrifty meals, and collecting Emma Bridgewater mugs. But moving swiftly on, Catherine, you were very inspired by some of the comments that FT readers left on your piece. Not all of them, I have to say, were particular fans of Instagram, although many of them found it very interesting to have this insight into a young person's financial world.
Well, yeah, so I was particularly interested. One comment from Wololo said, personally, I can't stand social media finance gurus. The intensely smug, we paid off our mortgage in our 30s humble braggers. The index fund fanboys parroting the same old advice ad nauseum. The FX trader lifestyle scammers, etc., etc. However, someone else, the phenomenology of logic, said, snide remarks from old school FT city types won't dent the undeniable expansion of Insta into areas scarcely imagined a couple of years ago.
Well, I mean, it is interesting the way that it's kind of divided the commentators. The one that really made me laugh was somebody saying, why does everything have to be a journey?
Yes. And then someone actually replied to, shouldn't it be a trip? So, which was quite funny. And another comment that made me laugh was Metro Man said, Insta is all cat videos and TikTok dances. And another commenter replied, Journeyman replied, it's curated to your own viewing habits, so apparently that's all you've clicked on.
Well, mess with these young people's tools at your peril, I think, is the answer. Now, stay with us, Catherine, because we're going to turn the tables now on the FT Money Show. We've heard Jason telling us what he thinks about Catherine's article on Instagram, but 2 weeks ago, in his Wealth Man slot, 50-year-old Jason wrote an article in which he explored the things that he wished he knew about money when he was 21 years old. Now, Jason, a lot of the things in this article were aimed at your own daughters, who are not much younger than Catherine.
Yeah, 21 and 16, yeah.
So they are developing their own stories about money, can I say. But the advice that you're giving people in this article, the things that you wish you had known when you were 21, talk us through a few of those.
Yeah, so we all have a different perspective on life and money. And obviously, when I was putting together my list, it was kind of looking at it from all the mistakes and my own upbringing. So everyone will have a different perspective. And this wasn't to say this is what you must do if you're a young person. It was to say this is what I've learned with my journey. You might come up with different answers if you've had a different, if we can use that journey word. But the issue there was that about the meaning of money was one that I was really keen for them to understand, that you hear people either are obsessed with money, or they think it's the root of all evil. You know, it's kind of, you go biblical terms, you know, everyone's horrible. And actually, money isn't good or bad at all. Money is just a sort of means of exchange. It's just a means of measurement. And it's what you do with the money and how you earn your money, which is probably more important than anything. So money has the meaning that you give it. And I always say here that although it can alleviate sadness, it definitely can, because if you're skint, and we know if people are in debt and they don't know where the next and they're living paycheck to paycheck or going to be thrown out of accommodation, that's a terrible thing, terrible way to live. And money can definitely make you happier in terms of getting rid of sadness and hardship. But money itself can't make you happy and fulfilled just to be rich for the sake of it. I mean, yes, you can be. All the studies show that if you have more money than most people, you have a higher chance of being happier. But on its own, it won't, because if you don't use it in the right way, if you don't use it in a way that's intentional with what's important to you and that makes you feel, you know, like a human being, a decent human being's got some purpose, then it's probably not going to help you.
Now, I think one of the biggest problems for young people nowadays is obviously the property market. If you're going to inherit wealth, then that's probably one of the only surefire ways that you can know that you will end up owning your own house in future. But in the meantime, people who are saving lots of money towards a housing deposit for many years are obviously finding it quite hard to achieve the same financial milestones that generations previous to them would have found much easier to reach.
Well, housing is a big issue. And as I said in my sort of article, that you really want to aim to have your housing and your commuting cost, whether that's renting or buying, certainly not more than 30 to 35% of your earnings. Obviously, in London, that's more difficult.
But impossible, I would say.
Well, no, it's possible, because I did research on this. As a company I do work with, Salary Finance, and the vast majority of their people are under the age of 35, and I asked 10 people, and most of them were between 25 and 34% was housing and commuting costs. So the issue here is not that it's difficult, we know it's difficult, but that you might have to rethink your career. It might be that actually there is a job in Newcastle that is a tech job, that actually when you actually add up the total cost of housing and the salary, that is actually a better quality of life for you. The problem is people think, London's where the jobs are. Oh, it's really expensive. Oh, isn't it really difficult? Well, reverse engineer it back. I'm not saying I've got all the answers. I'm just saying reverse engineer back, saying where could I work where there was a great stimulating job that could help me build my human capital, where I could have a social life, where I wasn't spending 2 hours commuting, and net of costs, it enabled me to not just enjoy life, but also put some money aside and avoid debt. So I think that was the point. It's not to say it's easy. It isn't. But think about it in a different way. Where could I have that quality of life? Where could I have that career? Where could I have that ability to save and avoid debt?
Now, when you were 21, what of all of the things that you suggested in your article is the piece of information that you really wished you had known?
Oh, developing good money habits. daily money habits, learning to say no more and to sort of, and just to be a little bit more controlled. I mean, I hired a nightclub for my 23rd birthday and I spent £2,000 on it. I mean, what lunatic does that? I mean, it was just something, it was a laugh. I just did it and it was a great party.
I was going to say, I bet it was a great party.
Even to this day, I bump into who say that they were at the party. I know damn well they weren't because I never invited them.
It's like the Sex Pistols.
I mean, we never had the White Horse coming in with Bianca Jagger, but we certainly had a few things going on and it was great fun. Nevertheless, it was great fun, but I'm using it as an extreme. I didn't even think about the long term. I just thought I was going to be young, I was going to earn lots of money and I never needed to worry. And it wasn't so much that, you know, I've tried to keep myself physically and mentally well, but I just wish I'd got into better daily habits earlier. And it was really getting married and my wife suggesting that we might want to start a family, and that I had to sort of get serious. And I just wish I'd done that 5 or 6 years a bit earlier. Doesn't mean I wouldn't going to be socialising. It perhaps meant a few less holidays, perhaps not such a flash car, perhaps not so much socialising and not having, you know, tailored suits and stuff. You know, just a little bit of less excess would have set me up for greater, because I sold my first property and lost £17,000 on it because I bought it in 1989 and sold it in 1994, and that was a property crash. So that's just another thing, is that just because property's done really well doesn't mean you're always going to be floated out of problems. And you've got to prepare for when life throws you curveballs. Mm. It's not if, it's when. And the big problem people don't think of is they don't plan for when it's going to rain. You know, fix the roof when the sun is shining. And one of the, you know, having a £2,000 tattoo when you haven't got any savings, I'm sorry, you've just got to make some key priorities, because if the price of having that tattoo and no savings when you lose your job or you get ill or something happens with your car means you've got no money and you have to get into debt, it's those small choices every day that really are, you are responsible. And that's one of the reasons why, when Catherine was saying that, I think you were saying actually earlier, that a lot of people find it very difficult to fess up about debt. And I know, because I put the O into overdraft when I was in my 20s, despite earning a lot of money. And the reason is because when we have to own up to debt problems, or the fact we haven't saved enough, or we can't afford a house, or whatever it is, and sometimes that's genuine, it's not your own fault. But for many of us, it reflects the fact that we feel stupid, we feel guilty, we feel shame, we feel embarrassed about the fact that we haven't been better with money than we should have done.
And also the fact that many people who are boasting about their lifestyle and their purchases on platforms like Instagram might be lying, or in the case of some ASOS shoppers, buying the clothes, trying them on, taking a photo and then sending them back. Catherine, you're smiling at me. I'm sure that you are not one of the people that ASOS has banned from its site for this practice. But you read Jason's column when it came out 2 weeks ago. If you want to read it, it's on ft.com/money at the moment. What would you like to ask Jason from the point of view of a 24-year-old seeking advice?
So yeah, so I did read your column and I actually said to the FT Money desk I was going to cut it out and put it in my purse because it's all the tips that I really need in my life. One quote stood out to me and it said, "The good news is you'll have a longer working life during which to save, invest and to accumulate wealth." So my question is, how can, as a millennial and a Gen Z, how can we feel optimistic about having to work into our 70s and 80s when previous generations didn't have to do that?
Well, the good news is you should be able to have more choices to the work. So all the studies show, and I'm not saying what's important to you, but so for instance, I'm fortunate that I'm financially independent as long as we don't go berserk on spending. Don't get me wrong, not buying boats and 9 houses, but you know, I choose to work because I like working. Right now, I'm not saying that to be smug. I'm saying that this is my choice. The thought of not working, and I just happen to get paid for what I do, but the thought of not working fills me with dread, because it's a key part of my life and I like doing what I do and it gives me fulfillment and purpose. So what I'm trying to say is that it's not about the drudgery of a job you hate. It may be that you have to do things you don't like or that aren't your passion or aren't your big calling just to earn money initially. But over time, the ability to keep earning money from gradually doing things that you really like and that are in balance with the other things you want to do, it means not necessarily working as intensely, but perhaps for longer. And I know lots of people who are working 2 or 3 days a week, earning as much as they're earning at 5 or 6 days a week, but still got time for other things. And they enjoy that because they actually now kind of know what they're doing. So I think if you really hate working and your big calling is to be an artist and no one's ever going to buy your art until you're dead, that may be more tricky. But I think it's actually supposed to be in a negative. I think personally, if you can find what you're good at, eventually, you don't have to be all through your life, and if you can find things that you can also deliver value to others and get paid for that value, then I think that's a good thing. So in other words, if you've got longer, all this idea of I've read various articles, including the FT, it says you've got to save so much money and it's you've got to live on beans and, you know, Rivitas forever, and you've got to, you know, if you spend anything on a holiday, you're a terrible person. I'm saying that a little for longer means that money's got more time to work for you. And if that means that you can work part-time, even if it's a job that you're not 100% right, but you can have more time to do other things, then I think it's a blessing in the sense that it's just a different way of looking at it. Because naturally, we want to think about all the pain and what we haven't got, and we want to blame the previous generations, and you had it easy and all that. Great. We never had the internet. We never had social media. We could never start businesses with microfinancing. There was none of this stuff. I mean, we used to go to the library to look up stuff. Do you remember? Well, you're younger.
I'm still a member of a library. Yeah, several libraries.
So does that sort of, does it give you a sort of sense? And again, side hustles. You know, I know someone who's doing counselling in her 60s. She stopped as a nurse and she's earning almost as much as she was as a nurse, as a counsellor. And she only does it 3 days a week and she loves it.
So, yeah, so from that, apart from what you said about Claire, about having better attitudes towards money, out of all of this advice that you give in your column, what advice would you say to begin with for a young person who's never budgeted and lives paycheck to paycheck?
First thing you've got to do is you've got to build your cash buffer. And what you have to do is, if you don't decide where your money goes before it comes in other words, the term from America was give every pound a job or every dollar a job. So unless you decide where every penny's going to go, as I always say to everyone, I have £1,000 a month to spend on fun. When I say fun, just anything I want to spend on. It could be, you know, I don't know if that's a lot.
Going to a nightclub.
Well, whatever. But, you know, coffees or whatever. I don't have to worry. But I put that money aside, and so does my wife, and we don't have to answer to each other. We don't have to. She's always running a big balance of that, and I'm always down to a pound. So I'm always asking for strategic transfers from her pot. And she said, no way, Jose. But the point is, we decide where our money goes at the beginning of the month. If you can get into the habit of doing it, and that means making allowance for socializing, making allowance for all those impulse purchases, making allowance for the holiday and those stag do's and all the tattoo you want to have, whatever it is, make allowance for it at the beginning of the month so that you then have got space for building cash reserve, building savings, putting a bit more in the pension, building the house fund, whatever it is, but it's being intentional and also giving yourself permission to spend the fun money as well.
As somebody who is a bit younger than Jason, but obviously a lot older than you, Catherine, I would add to that, number one, do not get a tattoo. I'm constantly saying to my stepchildren, don't let me see a tattoo when you go into the bathroom. But as I found in my own life, definitely decide what you're going to do with the money at the beginning of the month. But I also find it quite helpful to decide roughly what I'm going to do with the money at the beginning of the year, because you always get those 3 days between Christmas and New Year. And being a sad sack finance journalist, I will say to my husband, like, well, you know, well, where do we want to go on holiday this year? Roughly how much is that going to cost? Okay, so how much are we going to have to save towards funding those goals? What likely expenses are we going to incur in the form of the children? You know, like one of them has had an expensive dental implant on the cards for a while, you know, which is on the Barrett household shopping list. But also things like tax bills, which can be variable. How much money are we going to need to put aside for those? Now, I mean, if you were a younger person, then yeah, you'd be looking at housing deposits, maybe saving up to do a master's degree. I know lots of young people who want to do that. And it's just kind of like looking at how is it possible to put a bit of money aside every month that can kind of make some more of those goals possible. But a little bit of organisation can go a long way, because then if when your paycheck comes in, you've got money going out to, you know, a savings account. I know you can only get about 1.3% interest, which is now sadly less than today's inflation figures. But it's like the separation of like putting that money somewhere different that will stop you from
spending it. It's not the interest. Cash is about giving you options. It's about making if there's a financial calamity, or even if there is something that you haven't budgeted for that you really do want to deal with, it means a drama just becomes an inconvenience. It's not if, it's when. You can just handle it. And I wrote a blog on my own website last year called about how to get control of all your spending. And it is this irregular but inevitable spending, whether it's the car servicing, the holiday, or whatever it is, Christmas presents, that you have to factor in at the beginning of the year and put an amount aside. So if you're earning £1,500 a month and you think you're spending £1,200, well, actually, if you're actually spending £4,800 a year on other stuff, that's actually £1,600 a month. You're actually spending £100 a month more than you're earning. So unless you get to grips with that, it doesn't matter how much you earn, lifestyle creep, the ability for your spending to continually rise and sometimes quicker than your earnings, means that you'll never make space for buying a house, building retirement funds, building an emergency fund. And it's not complicated. But the thing here is, this is all about having fun now. It's not about living like a monk on Rivitas so that you can have the golden time, you know, when you're 35, because that isn't real for most people. It is about having permission so that when you go and spend frivolously on stuff that makes life fun and interesting and spontaneous, that you're not derailing yourself on the rest of your life. And that's why I created the Money on Track system, which is this one-year planner, which is where you can see everything from when your utility bills come up for renewal, your broadband and all that, so that you can actually, on all your core stuff as well, make allowance and make course corrections.
What do you think about all of this advice that us old farts are giving to you, Catherine?
I think it's brilliant, but I think also to bring back in the Instagram accounts and the Instagram personal finance accounts, it's kind of what they're also doing. It's the medicine and the cheese. It's the Trojan horse, as one of our Instagrammers like to call it. It's just reminding people that as long as they plan and they put a name to their money and they're just a bit more conscientious about it, then it can be easy and it doesn't have to be a chore.
Just being intentional, being aware, working out what's important. And it's not about no time, loads of time. It's a little bit of time. And it's not about being easy. It's about being easier. And we're all on our own journey, right?
Definitely.
Well, at which point the journey for this podcast has reached its final stop. Thank you very much for joining us. I am Claire Barrett, FT Money Editor. We will be back next week at the usual time. If you would like to contact us about a future item for the podcast, you can email me money@ft.com, follow us on Twitter @FTMoney, and Instagram, Financial Times, is the account to follow. We'll be back next week at the usual time. Goodbye.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost £27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.